Good morning. I'm Jim Packard, sitting in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Glad to have you along with us today for another edition of Garden Talk. Here in the studio with me is Bob Tomesch. Bob's a senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture for UW-Madison and Extension, and it's a pleasure to see you once again, Bob.
Oh, it's always good to be back here.
Thank you so much. Someone wanted to know what they could do about their shrubs, which were severely girdled by mice last winter. Is there any chance that they're going to be able to save them?
Well, they leafed out until everybody at this point of the game feels, hey, things are going well. But what's going to happen is probably around the first week of June, the leaf tissue is going to collapse because what has been happening is that the water is being pumped up through the wood, but there's no sugars to the root system, and the root's going to run out of energy. They still might be able to go out there and prune them right back to the ground, and what they'll happen is they'll send up some suckers from that root system, and that'll get things connected properly again.
Mm-hmm.
It's getting a little late to be doing that. That type of thing should have been done probably in April, but you can always take a chance because you're going to lose them one way or another. You can always hope.
And if they go out and take care of it now, they should be able to get good growth by the summer.
If it starts sending up suckers, then it'll send a regrowth up to maybe a foot or so. And it takes a couple of years when you do that severe pruning to get the plant back into its traditional size.
Mm-hmm.
But it can be done.
Our telephone number for you to call and give us your garden question is 1-800-642-1234. The email address here is talk@wpr.org. And Sandy in Superior emails, when rhubarb starts to grow seeds, should the stalk be cut off?
Yes, and she's talking about the seed stalk should mm-hmm. be removed. The goal of every plant is to reproduce, and that's an annual event that rhubarb goes through. And by removing that stalk, it redirects the energy back into producing some additional leaves, and you can continue harvesting from that rhubarb. If you leave that flower stalk there, then all the energy goes into seed production, and the plant just simply shuts down on its vegetative growth.
And also ask the question, when is the best time of year to trim off a few branches from a flowering crab? I don't think it's today.
No. The problem with during the summer months is we always are opening up the chance for diseases to get into those cuts. And probably why she wants to remove them is because she's finding them problematic. And I often encourage people to mark some of those branches, either putting a piece of tape on it or a little spray paint spots on the branches they want to remove. And then wait until the best time to removing on the flowering crabs would be any time from probably February through about the middle of April. When the plants are dormant and we've gotten past that cold period of December, January weather. And so by marking those branches, that'd be a good time to do it. I tell people the same thing with their apple orchards if they have cracks on a branch or something.
Mm-hmm.
And once you harvest the apples, the branch kind of goes back into place and they forget about it. But mark those damaged branches and then remove them during the proper time.
All right. Thanks very much, Sandy, for your email. And you can join her on that list at talk@wpr.org. Let's go to the phones to Molly in Appleton first. Hello, Molly.
Good morning. I have a rather odd question, and I'm hoping that you'll be able to help me.
Uh-huh.
We have a garden in the back of our yard that's probably about 6 feet by 8 feet, and we purchased this home about 6 years ago. And my question is, our neighbor informed us that the previous owners of our home buried a dog in this garden, and this is many years ago, and poured lye all over that area, then put topsoil on top and turned it into a garden. And we're curious to know the effects of lye and how long that actually lasts, and if that perhaps could be the reason why our tomatoes and peppers are not looking so great.
Well, usually when you apply lye to the soil, it raises the pH fairly high. And that could be part of the problem. What you might want to do is take a soil test and send it into the county extension office, and you'll get some results back. If there is some remediation that's necessary, in other words, to correct the soil pH, there would be some recommendations that would come with the soil test sample. And write down some of those details when you send the soil sample in so that they know what they're working with.
Okay, and would you expect that at some point we would be able to fix the problem and that the vegetables growing out of our garden would actually be okay to eat? I mean, are there some residual effects even if we correct it?
Well, the effects aren't, it's on the plant growth, not being absorbed into the plant. With the lye, it's like having too many wood ashes on a garden plot. It raises the soil pH, and then therefore certain nutrients aren't able to be absorbed by the plants. And so when that happens, plants grow very poorly, and you might have a situation like that. So a soil sample will, one, provide you with that information, where the soil pH is, and some possible remediation that might be necessary. And there's certain things that can be done, like I'm not saying add charcoal to it, but charcoal is sometimes used as a remediating material. It depends on what's there. The soil test will give you some of that information.
Excellent. Thank you so much for your help.
All right, Molly, thank you very much for the call at 1-800-642-1234 as we talk with Bob Tomesch. Let's go to Steve in Milwaukee next. Hi, Steve.
Hi, good morning, and happy springtime planting.
Thank you.
I have a question on behalf of my neighbor. It's a lilac question. He has three mature lilacs. Two of them are the French types, the standard purple. But he has one four-year-old yellow lilac, and he hasn't gotten a bloom off it in these 4 years. And I'm wondering if you have any ideas.
Okay. Well, a couple of things. First off, lilacs perform best if they're in full sun. And if it happens to be in a shady location, that could be part of its problem. Also, the yellow lilacs sometimes are not quite as vigorous. And also, some of the yellow lilacs sometimes succumb to some winter injury where the flower buds are injured, but the vegetative growth continues to grow. So, and the third thing is lilacs sometimes have to reach a certain age before they begin to flower, and maybe it's not quite old enough yet.
Okay, well, this one is right next to the other two French lilacs. It is in full sun, and it happens to be 4 years old.
Yep. It should start blooming. What I would do is, if he has the name of it or something like that, you could do some checking to see if what zone it's approved for. Some of these lilacs come out of areas where they're probably zone 6 plant material, and we're planting them. Even in Milwaukee, we're right on the border of 4 and 5. But when the winter temperatures come along, sometimes flower buds are damaged. So doing some little legwork might also give you some information.
Okay. The soil pH wouldn't have anything to do with it.
It shouldn't.
Shouldn't.
No.
All right. Thank you very much.
All right, Steve. Good luck to you. Thanks very much. Appreciate hearing from you. Let's go to Mike in Verona next. Hello, Mike.
Hello. Actually, sort of a lilac question and a black walnut question. I'll hit the lilac thing first. Is it too late to prune lilacs? I know you think that I've heard in the past where you take a third of the most mature wood. And then is it also too late to transplant lilacs?
Well, it would be too late to transplant. You can do it, but they go through a lot of shock when they have leaf tissue on. And so usually if we're doing any transplanting, we're doing it in the spring before we have any leaf growth. So that would be the proper time to do that. The other question with the lilac was pruning out or thinning out the materials. This, too, is best done when the plant is dormant. What will happen now is if you do the pruning, it just might not send up the sucker growth that you want over the period of time, and sometimes it would not harden off properly, so you're getting a little late. There's a very good extension bulletin on rejuvenating shrubs, and it'll give you some additional information at the time of year to be doing it and how to approach it.
Okay. And then the second question, or the other question I had, was about black walnuts. I have a black walnut that's very near part of my garden, and I've had a difficult time producing anything in there but beans. Beans seem to grow very well, sort of in the shade of the black walnut. I was wondering if there's anything else that'd be good to plant in that area.
There is a publication on plants that grow under black walnut trees. And I believe you can find that on the UW Extension website, and it will list some plant materials that you can. The problem is that even if you remove the black walnut, the juglan, which stymies growth, especially with the tomato plant family, is going to still remain there. And we've had cases where trees have been removed, and 10, 15 years later, they're still seeing the impact or the effects of this juglan being in the soil.
Right, so that'd be anything like tomatoes and peppers, ground cherries, I think that's part of the...
Right. All those are usually quite stymied by black walnut.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and that's on the UW what website?
Yeah, UW. Just go to the UW Extension Publications.
Okay.
CEcommerce.org, I believe, is that. And there's another list, probably the same list, but it's also available at the Jung website, jung.com.
All right. Thank you.
Okay, good. Thank you very much. Appreciate that. And again, the number for you, if you'd like to be included in Garden Talk, is 800-642-1234. And Anne in West Allis, let's get you into the conversation.
Good morning. I would like to know, when is the proper time to apply slug bait around my hostas, and also the Japanese grub bait that they really do a number on the roses?
Okay, you're dealing with two different problems. With the slugs, that product can be used anytime you have a problem.
Okay, I have two different products for those things.
Right, and just follow the label directions on each product. Different manufacturers have slightly different suggestions, but
okay.
Follow the label for slug management. And it's a good time to be doing it now, because if you reduce the population now, you're really reducing a lot of the population later into the growing season, because
okay.
They do rapidly multiply.
Yes.
Okay, with the Japanese beetle feeding on your roses, there are some products out there that can be used. Some of the products, like Sevin, works fairly well. Sevin, it's an insecticide. Of course, you have to follow the label directions. And, of course, you have some bee activity possibly happening around the flowers. And so there are some suggestions as to the time of day to be applying that type of product. That's about the insecticide. Some people have some luck with insecticidal soaps, and that's kind of hit and miss. But for some reason, the Japanese beetle, they'll pick a target, a certain plant, and it brings all the buddies in. We see it even on a row of grapevines. They'll pick one variety and just decimate that variety and leave some of the other ones alone. And as Phil Pelletieri, who would tell you, is that apparently once they start feeding on a plant, they submit some type of pheromone or attractant that brings everybody else into the feeding frenzy.
Mm-hmm.
I have this Japanese beetle grub bait that they say you can put on the ground while the grubs are in the ground. They appear. I know the Japanese beetles come in July.
Right.
So I imagine they're down there growing now, and I wondered if that was now the time to put
it. It should say on the label when to apply.
I couldn't see it. So okay, I'll look again.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you very much.
All right. Good luck. Thanks very much, Anne. Appreciate hearing from you. And again, our guest is Bob Tomash, senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at the UW-Madison. I'm Jim Packard. Brittany DeAnda is our on-air producer today. And you're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on this edition of Garden Talk. Glad to have you with us today. Bob Tomash is our guest. And if you'd like to join in, the number is 800-642-1234. Someone lives north of Madison noticed that some of their strawberry flowers had black in the center inside the petals.
And that would have happened last week. We had frost, I believe, or scattered frost in some areas from Madison northward. And what that is that frost has actually killed that flower and it develops a black center. We have some research projects over at West Madison, and so I checked on Monday to see what things look like. And
mm-hmm.
And the plants are in bloom, the strawberry plants, and none were affected by frost. But I gave a presentation on Wednesday evening to a group of master gardeners, and there were a couple that reported that their strawberries had been hit by the frost. And all it takes is a temperature of about 31 degrees, and we start seeing damage.
See that damage that
usually
fast.
If you suspect you have frost, you can go out and take a look in about 4 or 5 hours, and you can tell whether or not your strawberry plants or fruit crop for the future were damaged.
And one other question, how soon should someone fertilize their lawn if they feel it's necessary and have the best results?
If John Steyer were here, our turf specialist, he'd say, well, hold off till Memorial Day weekend, and we're there.
That's right. This is Memorial
right.
Day weekend.
And we've had a cooler fall, or spring, excuse me, and because of the coolness, the grass has been coming along fairly well, and now if you give it, and it's developed a fairly deep root system. So we're actually helping the grass out by waiting until now to do the fertilizer application. Everybody early in the spring likes to see that green, lush lawn, and so you end up with a shallow root formation. As soon as you start feeding it, the roots develop where they can obtain the nutrition. So waiting until now, you get your best bang for your buck. We suggest about 3 or 4 applications, one now on Memorial Day, one around the 4th of July, one about Labor Day, and then one wrapping up usually in October where we start putting on some of our winterizing type of fertilizer, getting those plants ready for good health so that they perform a lot better the following spring.
Back to the phones to Victoria in Fond du Lac. Hello, Victoria. What's on your mind today?
Good morning, and thank you for taking my call, and I'm from Bonduelle. I have the opposite problem with my lilacs. My yellow primrose is blooming. We bought it 2 years ago. It was 3 years old, and we've had blooms the last 2 years. We have the old-fashioned lilacs that were 3 years old when we bought them, and we've had them in the ground for 5 years, and they have done nothing, absolutely nothing. Their leaves are gorgeous. They're big, they're beautiful, but no flowers.
And are you fertilizing your lawn regularly?
No, we don't fertilize. We just
sometimes
do water, and that's about it.
Okay. Occasionally we have situations where when lawn fertilizer is applied very rigorously, sometimes some plants go into a vegetative phase. As with some of the other lilacs, they kind of go through a growth phase before they move on into that flowering phase, and it's possible that they're just not quite there yet.
Okay. So I should just keep hanging in there, and if next year I don't get any, don't dig them up?
I wouldn't write them off, no.
You have to be the eternal patient person.
Optimist, right.
Okay, well, gentlemen, I thank you very much for your answer, and I appreciate it, and I hope you have a great day.
All right, Victoria, thank you very much, and good luck to you. Let's go to Susan in Viroqua. Hi, Susan.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Yes,
okay,
of course,
great. I have a perennial bed with a lot of tulips, and I noticed this year that they appear to have a little bit of blight on them. So I got online and was horrified to see that it looks like I have what they're calling botrytis. Is that how you say it?
Yes.
And so my question for you is there any way I can amend the soil so that I don't have to take all the tulips out and what they suggested was destroy them?
Yeah. Botrytis, what happens is that it's a fungal disease, and mm-hmm. we see it on onions frequently. When you go out and buy onions right now and you get kind of a black or bluish cast to the inner leaves, that's probably what it is. The problem is that the fungus will stay in the soil for a couple, 3 years, even after you redo your bed. One of the things you might want to consider doing is you might have a situation where you have the area being a little too wet. And if you can possibly go to a raised bed with some of your tulips, you can sometimes bring some of those around. There are some fungicides that you can take a look at the garden center, kind of talk to the operator there and see if they have any that they would suggest for existing plants. But it's something that starts in that bulb, and even though the bulb goes dormant later in the year, it's down in those leaf areas on the bulb as it overwinters, and it can continue to be devastating and growing through much of the part when that bulb is dormant. So I would say just check and see if there is some type of fungicide you can use. Otherwise, go to a raised bed when you redo the bed.
Well, will the perennials be affected at all, or are they okay?
Well, it's a hit and miss. It likes the botrytis likes certain plants more than others, and your bulb crops happen to fall in that what category?
Bad. Okay. Can I ask one more quick question?
Sure.
I'm wondering if you could give me any tips on how to train a weeping larch.
Okay. Basically, you're talking about the pruning of the larch. One of the general rule for pruning is to try to space your branches kind of so they spiral around the tree, leaving a space of about 18 inches to 2 feet between each branch. This allows for, as that branch develops, sunlight to come in, and it'll give you a much healthier branch, and you'll have less self-pruning. where small little branchlets are falling off, and it'll give you an overall well-shaped, healthy tree.
Okay, thank you so much.
All right, Susan, thank you. Appreciate hearing from you. Somebody had some insect damage on their apples last year, and what do they need to do to prevent that problem from happening again?
Well, if it's insect damage, most of that happens starting now in June. And the first one that really becomes problematic is probably a coddling moth. This is they lay eggs and they kind of burrow in at the sepal end and they feed on the seeds, and they usually leave a trail back out. Many of the apples that are infected by coddling moth will usually fall to the ground because there's no seeds inside. The bigger problem are those that start showing up in July, and that would be the apple maggot. That makes the little brown trails in the fruit, and they oftentimes will start to deteriorate from other types of soft rot. In any case, you have to look at some type of pest management program. We're talking about insecticides as an option here, and it isn't a one-time spray Band-Aid. Most people, I sprayed once, I'm all done.
Mm-hmm.
It's something that once you decide to use either insecticidal soaps, whether you stay organic or use some of the other insecticides, you have to apply it about once a week or after a heavy rain so that protectant, whether it's a chemical or organic product, is there when the insect arrives. Some people have gone to bagging apples, and if you go on the internet and do a search, Minnesota has a bulletin on that. And that's where when the apple is about the size of a dime, you slip a plastic bag over the apple. Of course, you snip the ends on that bag, so as moisture builds up, it's got a place to run out. That way, when the insect shows up, hits the plastic bag, and then they can't get in. And it's also good protection for any of the fungal diseases like apple scab and things like that. So it works fairly well. We usually have a demonstration up at the West Madison Research Station with some of the fruit trees we have there, and we'll be doing that process probably in about 10 days.
Okay. Are you familiar with the name Lee Reich, R-E-I-C-H? He writes a lot of organic tracks, and I saw a story about a new book that he has that he will no longer plant apples. He will plant pear trees because they don't require that regimen of treatment that apple trees do.
Well, you still have apple maggot. You still have some of the other problems. And some of the pear varieties don't have as much scab problem. We also have some new apple varieties out there that are disease resistant, like Nova Easy Grow and Prima and Priscilla and some of those varieties. For a backyard gardener where you only have one or two apples, I would definitely encourage them to buy that type of fruit. Then mm-hmm. The only problem you have to deal with are the insects. There you have a choice of either some organic product or living with the product. I'm talking about the insect problems.
Yeah.
But you don't have the diseases impacting. And usually with an apple tree, we're doing field days in August and people bring an apple in and, it's apple scab and what do I do now? And you could give them the little, you got to start either spraying or whatever you're going to do. But so by going with the disease resistant apples, you don't have that problem.
Okay.
We always think of eating the fruit, but it also impacts leaves. If you look at the flowering crabs in any of the municipalities, usually around July 15th, all the leaves start falling off. That's because they are infected with apple scab. We normally never spray our flowering crabs because we're not eating anything
mm-hmm.
there. But it will, impact the entire tree.
Bob Tomash is our guest, and let's go back to the phones, and we will go to Joanne in Fitchburg next. Hi, Joanne. Joanne.
Bob Tomash is our guest, and
Bob, you've got to turn your radio down, Joanne.
To Joanne in Fitchburg next. Hi, Joanne.
Hello?
Yes.
Hello.
Thank you for taking my call.
Yes.
I have two quick questions. One is, I have a trumpet vine, which is on the south east side of the house, and it comes up every year. It grows very nice, has gorgeous leaves, but doesn't flower. And just like that lady's lilac, and if I transplant it, is it a good time to transplant now or in the fall? to west side?
Your best time to transplant your trumpet vine would be in the spring. As soon as the soil thaws and before any growth begins on it, then it would be the best time to move it. Sometimes the plants, there are certain things, trumpet vine, if you fertilize too well around the plant, it just starts absorbing a lot of nitrogen. Lack of sunlight will also cause that to happen. So there are some issues there.
Is it okay to transplant it now?
No, you have to do it in the spring before you have any leaf growth on the plant.
Oh, I see. So I have to wait until the frost last week, so I thought I should wait.
Yes, wait until next spring.
Next spring? Okay. Another quick question about the grass. Some of my grass died because of I sprayed to kill the buckthorn with Roundup. And got on the grass, and so there's some bald, patchy spots. So will the grass grow back again, or should I have to reseed them?
Well, first off, Roundup kills anything that's growing. And if you're going to apply it on stumps of buckthorn, make sure you hit just the stump and not the area around it. As for the dead spots, I would suggest just roughing those up a little bit and coming in with some type of grass seed, and it'll fill in fairly well.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay. Thanks very much, Joanne. And let's just advise other listeners that if you're calling, you must have your radio turned down because there is at least 5 seconds delay. And some hosts won't wait for you. They'll just go on to somebody else. Let's go next to Diane in Duluth. Diane, what's on your mind today?
We have some ewes that are 4 years old, and last fall we covered them with burlap. But this spring when we unwrapped them, there was a lot of brown needles. And I'm wondering if we did something wrong or if it was just because it was an exceptionally hard winter. And is there anything we can do?
Well, you're right about the fact it was a hard winter, and ewes are always very touchy. Another thing, ewes will often brown up if they're covered with a lot of snow, especially snow that was blown there by a snow blower or something like that. Okay, at the stage you're at right now, look for some new growth coming from the buds. And if you see that, that'll green up. Keep in mind, any needles on any of our conifers only last for about 18 months. In other words, one whole growing season. And the new growth usually masks the nice green growth masks the dead and dying needles, and we usually don't worry about it. So if you have that new growth, you're okay. Not much you can do other than trying to avoid piling snow on top of the ewes.
Okay, well, thank you.
All right.
Good news.
Diane, thank you very much for your call. Our guest is Bob Tomesch. Our number is 800-642-1234. Laverne in Muscadet wonders, he's starting an asparagus bed in the second year now. When should they expect to start harvesting that asparagus?
Well, you can start harvesting it the second year, but you don't want to over-harvest. And I usually tell people, if you're growing asparagus, continue to harvest the asparagus. But when the spears that are emerging are the size of a pencil or slightly smaller, it's time to stop. In other words, most of the energy has been utilized from that plant or the stored energy, and the spears are going to get smaller and smaller. When they reach that small size, then just stop harvesting, let the plant grow, and it'll spend the rest of the season reinvigorating those storage roots that are down there. And so you have a healthier crop for the following year. Usually the second year, you probably get one or two harvests off at the most. It's not until they're 3 and 4 and 5 years old that you can continue to harvest, sometimes all the way up to about the 4th of July.
Diane, thanks very much for your call then. We appreciate hearing from you. Rich is next in Charlotte. Hi, Rich.
Hi. Actually, in Shorewood. Thanks for taking
Shorewood.
My call.
Oh, Shorewood. Okay.
I've got kind of an unorthodox question about an unorthodox method here. I'm doing a little bit of window gardening, not indoors. Outdoors isn't an option for me. And what I found that is occasionally you'll get, a volunteer, as we call it, a potato or onion. And I can stick it in a quart mason jar half full of water, and it'll grow roots, and the plant will grow. I currently have multiple onions flowering, and, soon they'll seed. That seems to be pretty viable. I was wondering if you had any insights on that idea, or could think of any other vegetables that might be so willing to just grow with a little bit of water, and occasionally I'll dump you know, maybe a tablespoon of soil, organic soil on the bottom, just to keep, like potatoes, for instance, the leaves will go brown eventually. They need some nutrients. But I wonder if you had any thoughts on that.
Well, if you have enough sunlight, you can grow many of the vegetables. Some people will grow tomatoes, and especially the cherry tomatoes. They're quite vigorous. And again, you're just watching them grow in terms of their production activity. But you can, if there's enough light, you can grow almost any of them. Some of the plants, if there's not enough intense light intensity, it will impact their flowering if you're going to be harvesting fruit. Many times during the spring and early spring and fall, people use some of the leafier types of things like spinach and leaf lettuce, and some of those crops can be grown in a window space.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much, Rich. We appreciate hearing from you. And again, the number for you to call is 800-642-1234 and our email address, talk@wpr.org. Bob, is it too early to plant warm season vegetables like tomatoes and squash?
Well, we've had a tough spring. Every weekend's been cold. Mm-hmm. We're right at that stage now where the soil temperatures are reaching 50 degrees. And so we can start placing our warm season crops in the ground, and they'll start to germinate and grow. A couple of things that you can do to hasten, say we're using squash seeds or our favorite zucchini or whatever, is to make a little mound and set the seeds in the soil, but just fairly shallow, and keep it fairly moist. And that mound will heat up a little faster than just a regular flat soil. And so the early plantings right now, this will kind of give you an opportunity to get ahead. But yeah, the last two, 3 weekends have been cold and wet, and so people really haven't been out doing a lot of gardening. But I think things have turned around, and this is going to be the weekend if
this
they're
is
in
the
town.
Weekend to get started.
Definitely.
On things.
So, yep, go ahead and start. Our chance of frost, at least here in southern Wisconsin, has passed. Northern Wisconsin, they usually talk about the Memorial Day weekend or the first week of June to start with the warm season crops, and I think they're fairly safe, although they had a heavy frost last week.
Yeah. Kathleen in Madison, let's get you into the conversation. Hello.
Hi there. I just had another question about Japanese beetles. Last year, my husband and I used one of those pheromone attractor traps for them. And, you know, where they, you put it in the bucket and they all kind of go in and die in there. And I wasn't sure if that was really just exacerbating the problem where they would, I would just get more of them in my yard even though I was killing them. I just want to know what you thought about those.
Well, you should hang them over in your neighbors. What happens when you use those pheromone traps is it's like having great perfume or cologne, and it attracts insects in from all over. So you're going to have more feeding in your yard because of the pheromone trap. So I would not utilize that idea.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Okay, Kathleen. Thanks very much. An email from Barb. Do you recommend rubber mulch for plants, especially grapevines?
Mulch.
I don't think I've seen rubber mulch, but...
Well, they use it in playgrounds around the base of playground equipment. It's ground up tires usually or some type. It does work as a surface mulch. It's fairly high. It's organic, but it's a real bound organic. It's never going to break down. You can use it as long as there's water that can penetrate through it to get to the grapevine, and it'll work fairly well.
Shire in New Berlin, let's go to you next. Hi.
Hi, how are you?
Very good, thank you.
Good. I have a question about, I believe it's a red Concord grape, and it grows over my pergola, and we inherited when we moved into the house. And a couple years ago, it was maturing, and I got about 80 pounds of grapes for a couple of years. And last year and the year before, I'd say I even got about 100 pounds. But what's happening is the grapes are starting to drop off prematurely before they ripen. And pretty much my deck is just covered with grapes, and there's really nothing harvestable from it. Any thoughts on that?
Well, can I ask a question? Have you been pruning it each year?
I prune it every year.
Okay.
It's, you know, there's probably a good maybe 8, maybe even 10, you know, branches off of it that I keep trimmed back.
Yep. Usually with a grapevine, we try to save about... 40 to 50 buds per plant, and that's a fairly well balanced that the fruit then does develop after that will usually be larger and remain on the individual plant. In your case, there may be some small insect that may be causing part of the problem too, where they're feeding on it and severing the berries off. I do have a publication I'd have to take a look at where it's got IPM for grapes, but usually the berries, they'll stay on the plant unless something, either they're too many, and that's why I suggest to do the pruning down to about 40 to 60 buds per plant. Or the other thing would be, it could be you have some type of insect problem that's causing that problem. And I can't tell you which one it might.
Evidence of the bugs?
Pardon?
Would I see evidence of the bugs if there were insect activity?
Probably not, unless you look very, very close.
Okay.
And I just couldn't tell you which one it is, but I do know there's a girdling type of grape insect. I very seldom see it, but it's always possible that it could be doing that.
Okay. Very good. Thank you so much.
All right, Shire. Good luck to you. Thanks very much for the call. Appreciate hearing from you. And let's go to Rich in Chippewa Falls next. Rich, what can we do for you?
Hi, guys. I used a crabgrass preventer this year, and I've got some bare spots in my lawn. I know on the bag for the crabgrass preventer, it said not to reseed your lawn for 4 months after the application. There, if I take some seed and throw it in with some topsoil in the wheelbarrow and mix it together and throw that on the bare spots, do you think that would grow, or is it impossible to grow new grass in those bare spots that I've put the crabgrass preventer over?
Well, the way the crabgrass preventer works is it keeps root development from happening on seeds, and you're trying to do that to the crabgrass, and it will do the same thing on regular grasses. You could try, I'm just saying try, I dig out a little bit of soil, maybe in that dead spot that you have, try to take out a couple, 3 inches, and then refill it with that topsoil you've put together, and you might be able to get some regrowth.
Sounds good.
Okay. Good luck to you. Yeah. Sounds like a plan. Our guest is Bob Tomesch. He's a senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at the UW-Madison, and let's give Lynn in Sand Creek a chance. Go ahead, Lynn.
Hi. We just put in a vineyard, and we intentionally made the trellis system longer than we needed, so we've got 48 feet of trellis that doesn't have the grapes on it. In 24 feet of that, I put two apple trees that I'm training on the trellis, and I still haven't decided what to put on in the other 24 feet. I was thinking of cherries. I wonder how they would grow on a trellis system or some other sort of fruit that might be good there.
Okay, with cherries, I would, in your area, I'd only go with the sour cherries. There's, and that would be probably Meteor or North Star that are hardy enough to produce fruit year after year. The Montmorency, we're starting to get into an area where you're going to have winter damage on that, and any of the sweet cherries would definitely be out. But you could trellis those. Both Montmorency and North Star tend to be small statured trees, only get to a height of about 12 feet. So that would be one of the options. Pears would be another very good choice that you can trellis and have very good success with the pear varieties. More grapes, of course. Other than that, with tree types of fruit, when it gets down to, there are some plums you might want to take a look at. There's a very good one, Alderman, released from the University of Minnesota. And there's a new one that will hit the market next year. It's going to be called Black Ice. And that one was developed by Brian Smith at the University of Wisconsin at River Falls. It was formerly called Lidecker, but they've changed the name to Black Ice, and it should be available. So I would go with some of the plum varieties. Also, when you look at plums, there are some that are very early and some that are very late season. And you could kind of spread some of that harvest out. With the Alderman, you're talking about a plum that's at least 2 inches in diameter, very sweet, dark purple. And some of the old Superior and some of the South Dakota varieties would be other options.
Are they self-fruitful?
Usually with plums, you normally don't have to worry too much with the exception of some of the South Dakota varieties, and that is because we have so many wild plums that they will provide the pollen for the plum varieties. Now, when it comes to the South Dakota selections, and if you look in the catalog, it always suggests two varieties, and that is because when they were developed, they're a hybrid, and sometimes they may not accept a normal plum type of pollen, so that's why the pollinator is very important.
Will Alderman probably be available at some local nursery?
I'd check around. There are nurseries up in your area. You should be able to find it. Bailey's Nursery, which happens to be in South St. Paul there, they carry it. And just calling them, they would tell you who is a vendor that would provide that tree.
Very good. Thank you.
Okay. Thanks a lot, Lynn. Good luck to you. Our guest on Garden Talk today, Bob Tomisch, Senior Lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at the UW-Madison. I'm Jim Packard. You're listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Jim Packard on Garden Talk. You're on the Ideas Network with Bob Tomisch, who's in the Department of Horticulture at the UW-Madison. We're taking your calls today on Garden Talk. The number is 800-642-1234. Our email address, talk@wpr.org. Mary in Baraboo emails, "I've noticed in my yard and many others large cocoons or nests with long caterpillar-like worms in them. What do they turn into, and will they harm the tree?"
Those are tent caterpillars. Those are tent caterpillars, and they prefer the cherries and some of the apples, those types of crops. They're going through their cycle right now, and they will crawl into the soil. And later on, they'll go through their adult life cycle. I couldn't tell exactly what the adult would look like. That's a question for Phil Pelletieri when he's on. But they're very prevalent. I was going up the interstate yesterday, and there happened to be an area, and I would guess every tree had 50 to 100 cocoons in it, and they were just completely defoliating the area. And that population has been on the increase each year. If you look very carefully, if you happen to have an orchard tree and you happen to see the plants, you can usually find those egg masses. They look like somebody, kind of a little grayish spackling that kind of wraps around the branch, and that's where it overwinters and will hatch next spring.
My wife made the observation about those as well going up I-39.
Yes, there's some.
That was the highway?
Right in that center area.
The center of Wisconsin there going north. Yeah, she'd seen the same thing and asked me the question. So I'm glad that you're on today to be able to provide an answer. Let's go to Molly in Madison next. Hi, Molly.
Yeah, hi. I planted some shrubs and plants, mainly hostas, in the fall, quite late, like in September, October. And I'm wondering, could I or should I put root starter or fertilizer? Or some kind of a root stimulator fertilizer on them this spring. I didn't do it in the fall.
Are they growing now?
Uh-huh.
Okay. It would be good to provide some type of fertilizer, or you could either go with some organic type of fertilizers that are out there, or some of the inorganic types. There's a very good bulletin on perennials, and in there it gives a fertilizer recommendation based on the number of square feet that you have the space that plant takes. And it's an extension bulletin. It's out of Michigan, but plants can't tell if they're growing in Michigan or Wisconsin. But it's one that we utilize here, and it's growing perennials. And I would suggest that you look there for some suggestions.
Right, but the starter fertilizer would be the one to put on?
Well, starter fertilizers usually carry a phosphorus product in them. And that is that fertilizer is mainly for seeds when they first start growing, so that they have available source of nutrients. The other fertilizer, or the fertilizers that we usually put on our side dressing right now, and after this year, they'll probably only contain nitrogen and potassium because of the phosphorus ban that's going on across the state.
Right. Oh, and one other thing, I have a new grass area, and there's quack grass growing up in it. Is that going to take over?
No. Usually with constant mowing, it keeps mowing off the growing point on quack grass, and after a couple, 3 years, usually the mower wins the battle.
Make sure you have it set high enough.
The other thing you can do is if it really grows up tall enough, you can take some Roundup solution and put a rubber glove on, and then or take a paintbrush and just kind of paint those quackgrass stalks, and it'll absorb that Roundup. But you don't want to drop it on the regular grass,
no,
because then you got a bigger patch to fix.
Yeah, and nimbleweed, will that get will that take over?
That usually takes over in areas where you have a poor turf grass. In other words, it provides openings for the seeds to get started.
Okay. All right. Okay, thank you.
All right, Molly, good luck to you. Thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. We had an email from Joseph in the Twin Cities. My indoor plant experienced root rot and then proceeded to die. What causes root rot?
Well, root rot, I'm kind of trying to guess if it was transplants that he was growing. And then there's several types of like Pythium and things like that that can cause that. Many of those are found normally in the soil. And a couple of things. One is you're trying to keep things from being overly wet. Mm-hmm. You get root rot on some of your house plants and things like that if you overwater.
They don't like wet feet.
Well, that's true. And what happens is if it's too wet, the disease is growing faster than the roots, and so the plant can't outgrow the problem.
Mm-hmm.
Usually when we're starting transplants, we sometimes will find one of many different types of diseases. Pythium is one that looks like somebody took a roller and kind of rolled over the little seedlings that you have started, and that organism grows right on the soil surface. And again, it's just too wet of an environment. You're not allowing that topsoil to dry out in your little starter bed.
All right, let's go back to the phones, and we will go to Sylvia in Appleton next. Hi, Sylvia.
Hi.
Go ahead.
I have a row of hollyhocks along a fence. They were beautiful last summer. They're coming up now pretty well, but part of them have a rust on them.
Well, you've guessed that one right, rust. Some types of hollyhocks are more susceptible to rust. I'm surprised it's this early in the year, but you never know when certain things come along. There are some type of soap products that will help deter that problem. You can go down to a garden center if you're choosing to go or try the organic. Otherwise, there are some chemicals that can be used for the rust. If you're applying it now, the new leaves that emerge would be protected as long as you have that product on there.
Okay. You don't know, do you know the name of the product?
No, I would go down and do some searching.
Okay.
Just tell them what your problem is and they'll have a product. The rust on hollyhocks is common enough that mm-hmm. you should be able to find something there.
Okay. Also, something is eating the little bitty ones. Would that be rabbits?
Could be. Rabbits okay. or slugs.
Oh, slugs. Oh, yuck. Squirrels?
throw a board down and, overnight and the next morning look under the
Turn
board.
Turn it over and see
what
you've
got. You've got. Yeah.
See who's there.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, that was it.
All right, Sylvia. Thanks very much. Appreciate hearing from you. And let's go to Mary in La Crosse. Hi, Mary.
Hi. When I just tuned you in, there was a grass question, and I thought maybe it was a lawn specialist, so I hope you can answer. I've been in and out. Such a beautiful day, and I'm planting like crazy today, all my pots and everything. I have a 20x20 patch of grass that was mostly weeds, and that's been sprayed and killed down. And what I wanted to seed, and I haven't been able to find here in La Crosse, is that low-mow or no-mow grass seed that the lawn specialist has talked about. And I wonder if you know an official name for it and if you have any idea of a resource.
Usually if you go to the garden centers, they will carry that grass. It's usually a type of fescue. It gets to a height of about 10 inches and stops growing. You can do the same thing with regular lawn grass. It'll only, the Kentucky bluegrasses, will get to a height of about 8-10 inches and kind of stop growing. But most people, they want to try this other one because they figure they don't have to do anything anymore, but you'll still have to mow if you want to keep a...
Prairie Nursery would be one source for that.
That would be another source, yes.
Prairie Nursery?
Yes. Mm-hmm.
Okay, because I tried the garden centers in La Crosse, and nobody's even familiar with it, so...
Try the Prairie Nursery, and I think they called it the Lomo.
All right, thank you very much.
Okay.
Bye-bye.
Thanks very much. We appreciate hearing from you. And let's go to Andy next in Milwaukee. Hi, Andy.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. My house is on what used to be a commercial orchard maybe about 7 years ago. And I still have nine apple trees hanging on. I'm not sure what the variety is. But this last season I saved about a dozen apples, put them in the garage so they would freeze because I was going to try and grow some by seed. When I went to my local garden center, they basically told me I wouldn't really have any luck. I wondered what thoughts your guests might have and whether or not I should consider trying to do some sort of graft on the tree I already have or the trees I already have.
Okay, the trees you already have, if you want to perpetuate any of those, you have to graft or take cuttings of cyanwood and graft it onto rootstock. When you save seeds, you don't know what you get. Most cases, you're going to get a flowering crab type of fruit. And you've waited probably 8-10 years from the time you started the seed until you end up with flowers and fruit, and then you're very disappointed. I've got some slides where they saved, took 100 seeds from a apple tree and planted them, and the color ranges from yellow to reds to greens and all sizes in between. So if you want to perpetuate what you've got there, contact somebody that does some grafting, and they can probably help you out.
Okay, is there an internet resource you might direct me to find someone? Or
send me an email.
Okay.
Or if you send it to public radio here, Jim usually forwards it on to me.
Sure, you send it to Packard@WPR.org, and I'll get it to Bob.
Great, thanks a lot. Have a great weekend.
All right, thank you very much for the call. And we appreciate Bob being here today. He's a senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture, UW-Madison, and Extension. If someone does want to email you, your email address, Bob?
It's RJ Tomesh, T-O-M-E-S-H, at wisc.edu.
All right. A reminder that coming up Monday after 11, we'll be talking about the beauty of bird watching in Wisconsin with Bill Volkert of the DNR, stationed at the Horican Marsh, and Noel Cutright of the Wisconsin Society for Ornithology. Our thanks to Brittany DeAnda for on-air phone production today. I'm Jim Packard, and you're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Jim Packard with you on Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We'll be talking with Bob Tomesh. So far, we've talked about lye in the garden and yellow lilacs, pruning lilacs, talked about the effects of black walnut on your gardens, slug baits, Japanese grub baits, purple lilacs. We've talked about diseased soil with botrytis, the coddling moth, the apple maggot, trumpet vines, used with brown needles, Japanese beetles, crabgrass preventers, cherries on trellis, hostas, and a whole host of gardening questions still to come. So if you'd like to get your questions answered, if you have suggestions for other people as well, then our number is 1-800-642-1234. Our email address is talk@wpr.org. More after the news. Good afternoon. I'm Jim Packard in for Larry Mueller on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Good to have you with us today for this edition of Garden Talk. Bob Tomesh, a senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at the UW-Madison, is our guest. Bob, once again, thanks for coming in today.
Always good to work with you, Jim.
Here's my big question for you. Should sweet corn be planted in rows, or does it make a hill of beans?
Well, when it comes to sweet corn, they suggest planting it in a block of about four rows, and just even if they're short rows. And it has to do with the pollination process, that when you have the pollen coming from the tassel all the way down to the ear, it's better apt to, or more apt to be pollen. Otherwise, you have to rely on flying pollen coming in, and sometimes if you happen to live in a rural area or near the edge of Madison or something like that, you'll have field corn pollen come in and doing the pollinating.
Yeah.
So they usually recommend a block of about four rows, even though if the row is only maybe 8-10 feet long.
And a couple of notices that we want to take care of. The first meeting of the Wisconsin Peony Society will be at the West Madison Agriculture Research Station, which is located at 8502 Mineral Point Road in Verona, tomorrow at 3:30 p.m. Special guest speaker is the president of the American Peony Society, Harvey Buchheit, and he'll present a presentation on the wonder world of peonies, covering species hybrids, tree peonies, hybrid tea peonies, and intersectional peonies. And they are inviting anybody who has a passion for growing that plant to attend. That's at the West Madison Ag Research Station on Mineral Point Road in Verona tomorrow afternoon at 3:30. And just a notice of a couple of other things going on. The Dahlia Society of Wisconsin's plant sale is in May 30th and June 6th. That'll be at the Brookfield Farmers Market near Brookfield City Hall. The Herb Society of America Wisconsin unit holds its 26th annual Spring Herb Fair and Plant Sale on May 30th through the day at Berner Botanical Gardens in Hales Corners. So we've got one more. The Northern Lights Master Gardeners Association is having their annual spring plant sale. That's at Harmony Arboretum Garden Site, 7 miles west of Marinette. Have you been there, Bob?
Been there.
Yeah, watch for the signs. Wide selection of plants will be sold there. That's on the 30th of May as well. So must be the time for the plant sales.
Well, plant sales, and things have been a little slow because we've had about 3-4 weekends that are relatively cool or wet, and people haven't been out. And as you could tell, one of the gardeners that called in a little while ago said that she's trying to sneak in to listen to the radio while she's trying to get her garden going.
She's trying to get her garden going. Jeff in La Crosse, let's go to you next. Hi.
Hi there. I got a rather large asparagus patch, and it's been doing pretty good. It's probably 7 or 8 years old, and doing pretty good, getting harvesting, I don't know, between 15 and 25 pounds a year, I guess, without picking it real hard. And this year, it's just looking real sick, so I did a soil test, and I discovered that I have pHs of about neutral. Nitrogen is a little bit lacking. Potash is good, but phosphorus is off the chart low. And I'm pretty sure that asparagus likes phosphorus, and I'm looking for a nice organic source of phosphorus.
Well, one organic source would be bone meal products, which are available, which do have phosphorus in them. And those are available, sources like Gardens Alive and some of those that carry organic products will contain or suggest that. One of the other things that could be happening if it's not doing real well there's a couple of issues. One, sometimes if you have a buildup of a grub population, it can be devastating to the roots to some degree. But the other thing is, if you harvested too long, remember one of the first questions we had today was that how long do I harvest asparagus? And once those fronds are less than the diameter of a pencil, it's time to stop harvesting from that hill or whatever, even though some of the other hills are larger. So it's just the carryover. Usually with asparagus, if you can come in with a fertilizer application after you're about done harvesting, and that kind of gives it a shot in the arm for next year.
Yeah, okay, so bone meal. I do have a grub problem, and the only reason I know that is because moles devastated my patch. I mean, they just turned it into an unruly gangle of...
And the moles aren't eating your asparagus. They're only after the grubs. And so that's the grub problem was just a guess, but I've seen that happen.
Yeah.
And in terms of management for grubs, there are some insecticides that are designed for grubs. And again, you're working with a food crop, and so you have to probably apply those after you're done harvesting your asparagus.
Thank you very much.
All right, Jeff, thanks very much. Appreciate hearing from you. The number is 1-800-642-1234 as we go to Wausau and see what's on Joe's mind. Hi, Joe.
Hello. Question about ever-bearing raspberries. Would there be much difference between Autumn Britain and Polana?
Autumn Britain is going to probably ripen a week or so earlier than Polana. Autumn Britain has more erect type of cane. Polana tends to be kind of a cane that's a little bit weaker and tends to hang a little bit to the side. While you're trying to decide which one you planted where?
Yeah, I'm just trying to decide which one to go with, you know.
Oh, you mean before you plant?
You're making your choice.
Oh, making your choice.
I thought you were trying to figure out what you did.
I have people that plant and say, what have I got? I would pick either one. Because we've got some in demonstration plots, and I've been very impressed with Polana. Autumn Britain might be just a little earlier than the Polaina in terms of ripening. And again, with any of the fall-bearing raspberries, when they're done, when you're done, and in the fall, when the soil begins to freeze, or early in the spring, cut all the canes down, because if you happen to leave some of those canes to fruit into the second year, it's going to slow down the fruit production on the new primal canes by as much as 3 or 4 weeks. So you want to get those in and producing as early as you can. So I would go with the early Briton, as a possibility for early harvest, and Polaina is going to be about a week to 10 days later.
Are the berries about the same size as sweet?
Oh, you're going to get a little bigger berry on the Polaina.
Oh, okay. How about sweetness?
About the same.
About the same. Another question about rhubarb. Valentine versus Canada Red, same difference, or?
I don't have that much expertise on that one in terms of flavor.
Okay. Thank you.
All right, Joe. Good luck. Thanks a lot for the call. And let's go to Mary in Belleville next. Mary, what can we do for you?
Hi, it's asparagus day, I guess.
Okay.
We have a planting which is 12 to 14 years old and has been very successful in the past. But about 3 years ago, we noticed that at one end of the bed, we were getting a lot of spindly growth. I mean, immediately, it never came out with heavy stalks at all. And this increased last year. Now, this year, our harvest is very small because although we have lots and lots of growth, it's all spindly. Are we fertilizing too much, too little, or what?
Can I ask you one question? Yes. Have you been using Roundup around the plants?
No.
Okay, thank you. Sometimes I see the carryover of some herbicide. One of the things I would watch by spindly, you're talking about plants that kind of twist as they come up?
No, I'm speaking about lots and lots of growth coming up, but it's all very thin, less than pencil size.
I don't think you're not. It could, if you're doing anything, you're probably not fertilizing enough. And the other thing, it could be the same as the other person observed, he's having a high grub population. And if you use a lot of mulch like bark chips or something like that, that usually is a place where they like to reside. So there's a very good publication. It's called Growing Asparagus in Minnesota. And it's a very detailed one. You can usually find it on the internet or order it through the internet, through the St. Paul publications. But that one has a lot of detail on it, and it also describes some of the problems associated with growing asparagus, and maybe you can match something up.
Could I ask another question?
Mm-hmm.
We have two hollies, a male and a female, which have done very well for about 8 or 10 years. But last winter, even though we covered them with burlap, they almost totally burned off. Can I renovate them by cutting them off down near the ground, or are hollies not amenable to that?
You should be able to. It depends on by holly, which one are you talking about?
The ones that do okay here. The ones that will survive here. I can't remember. Are they China girl and China boy?
Yes. Last winter was very hard on some plants because we had temperatures even here in the Madison area down to minus 28 degrees. And that is one of the crops that were affected. And the other thing is that I think Brian Huddleston had mentioned he'd gotten several samples of disease. And many times when a plant is stressed, like with the cold temperature, the new growth is more susceptible to some disease entry. So I would prune those back, and that's about all you can do, and hope that the new growth that occurs. And be real vigorous with your pruning. Get down to the good, healthy buds.
Actually, the only thing that survived pretty much were the branches that were under the snow all winter.
Yep, they were mulched.
Yes. Thank you so much.
All right, Mary. Thank you very much for the call. And Bill, in Menominee emails, what would you recommend for espalier along a driveway that gets full sun in the summer and no sun in the winter?
And espaliating, if he's talking fruit or what type of crop, I guess is the winter espalier doesn't worry me too much because sometimes even shade is good for it because the sun isn't shining on your plants, but. Full sun in the spring, anything you want to try to work with. And many people, when they start doing espaliate, that's where you're kind of training the branches in a flat plane. Some people espaliate plant materials along the side of a house or places like that. And they often will pick fruit crops like apples or pears or something of that nature and train the branches. I've seen people, there's a Belgian type of spelly where you kind of do a crosshatch, and that's quite showy. Do a web search on a spelliating, yeah. And you come up with lots of ideas.
And Alan emails, I have several nice hosta plants surrounded by lilies of the valley. Will the lilies choke out the hostas?
No. Hostas, well, what will happen is lily of the valley pops up in the spring and usually leaves out, and then it has some leaf tissue. But the hostas are usually taller and denser, and many times the lily of the valley, even though it kind of works its way in the spring, but then the shading part just kind of keeps an open space. So I don't think it will. Although lily of the valley is considered to be a real hardy, invasive type of plant, given the right conditions, but I think hosta will hold its own.
Our guest is Bob Tomash, senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture at the UW-Madison, and our next caller is Pat in East Troy. Hi, Pat.
Hi, Jim. Thank you for having your guest. Very appropriate. I'm glad that you gave the information about the tent caterpillars and the flowering plum trees, which I would have trimmed in order to get rid of the tent caterpillars. Instead, I picked them off by hand and stomped on them.
And you felt better for it, right?
I'll do my trimming at the appropriate time.
All right.
My real question is that as I was doing yard work this morning, my recently transplanted either bur oak or red oak trees are having a terrible case of leaf wilt. I was so enthusiastic when I saw them leafing out a week ago or 2 weeks ago, and now they're all curling and shriveled and look like they're not getting any nourishment. Do I have the dreaded oak wilt?
I couldn't tell you, and you have only the red oaks, right?
I have red, white, and bur oaks that I know of.
And they're all looking wilty?
Well, these that are close to our country road, which is across from a farmer's field, are the ones that are most affected. But I do have one old one that has been here since the 1800s, and that has been having wilt shriveled leaves. After leafing out, it goes into this decline for several years, and I had an agent from the county come and tell me, don't worry about it, it'll be okay, but it doesn't look okay to me.
Well, first of all, usually we do get some wilts that are caused, it's just a damage to, like an anthracnose that starts on the leaf tissue. I haven't noticed any, but it could be starting. That's one possibility. On the cross from the farmer's field, have they been applying a herbicide or anything like that?
I think I remember seeing something with a tank behind it going past a couple of weeks or 3 weeks ago, maybe.
Yeah. It almost sounds like you may have some drift that might be occurring, and that's always hard to nail down because unless you see it actually happening, and then the cause right after that. And I'm guessing you might have some effect from that, but I can't say for sure. And you can't just go out and take a leaf sample and send it in and get the results. It's very costly, and especially if you don't know what the product is. But I would talk to the person that's farming across the road and explain that you're having some problems. Some of the plants that will show, like if a box elder, will tend to show some damage.
I can only dream I could get rid of the box elder that's in the same
You don't get rid of it. It just causes the leaves to curl and look kind of kinky.
Oh.
They'll all live that. But when I'm looking for a drift, sometimes I'll look at box elder as one of the plants as a kind of an indicator. There are some other weeds that you can look at. But I'm guessing that that's probably what might be happening there. But I can't tell for sure.
Is there any tests that I can do to find out if it is oak wilt, and if it is,
yes, if
then what can I do?
Send a sample in to the pathology lab here on campus, and Brian Huddleston will do an analysis for you. I think there's a $20 charge. Check with your local county extension office. They've got forms to fill out, and then it'll also tell you the type of portion of the plant to take. And the best day to send it in is usually on Monday or Tuesday, so it gets here before the weekend.
And Brian will be our guest along with Laura Jell next Friday on Garden Talk.
There you go.
So it's very appropriate that you call, Pat.
Thank you very much for the helpful information.
Okay. Thanks, and good luck to you there in East Troy. Let's go next to Wayne in Green Bay. Wayne, what can we do for you?
Yes, good afternoon. I also have a leaf problem, but not with an oak. This is a maple, a small maple tree about 5 foot tall. For some reason this year, leaves came out really nice, and now I see yesterday that it's the leaves are full of little pimples, I'll call it. They're about 20 to 30 on each leaf.
Yep.
And what would that be, and what can I do about it?
Well, one, you don't have to do anything about it. It's a cosmetic program, but a problem, but I'll tell you what it is a small little insect that's very small, you can hardly see it, has laid an egg on the leaf, and as the larvae develop inside of each one of those little galls that you see there, it's something that happens this time of the year. The new leaves that are up here won't have that because that insect only lays it during a certain time, and some of them turn nice and red, and some are yellows and other colors like that. But that's what you have. But it's a cosmetic thing. Don't worry about it. Trees have been subjected to that problem for years and have lived through it.
Funny thing is, I have three maples back there. There's different varieties, and they're about 50 feet apart. The little one is the only one that has it. Maybe I'm lucky in that respect, but it's just loaded with them.
Yep. This year I've seen a lot of it.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
All right, Wayne. Good luck to you there in Green Bay. I had an email from Lars in Lake Mills, wants to know if it's safe to use newspapers in the garden for smothering weeds between the rows.
It works great.
It does, and the newspaper people will love you for it, too.
Yeah, usually you can lay it out, but you got to have something on top of it to hold it down. Some people put compost on top. Or
long boards.
Yep, just to hold it. Otherwise, the newspaper ends up in your neighbor's yard and things like that. But it does keep the new weed seedlings as they emerge. They don't see the light of day. And I usually use about 6 layers of paper. And then when the season's over, you can kind of just dig that newspaper into the soil and it serves as a compost.
All right, sounds good. Let us go next to Bill. And, Bill, what's on your mind?
Before I ask my question, another good thing to throw on top of the paper is grass clippings.
Mm-hmm.
That works very well.
Okay.
Especially if they're wet and just before it rains.
Sure.
The other thing is I've been using organic fertilizer and also bone meal when I plant my tomato plants and peppers and so forth, and something is coming and digging them all up. It's happened 3 times already this year. I planted 3 times, and I wonder if there's anything you can put out there to discourage critters from some bad-smelling stuff. I don't know. I thought of moth crystals, but I don't think they're strong enough. Is there anything that the guy can use for
you? Probably a cattle dig. You know, the bone meal has a kind of like a fleshy type odor, and usually skunks, possum, cats, and it's probably happening at night, will come and dig out those plants. There are some products that you can go in and you could spray around the base of it, and that will help. One of the other things you might try is I've taken like a kitty litter bucket, cut the bottom out of it, and just set that around to protect the plant for the first couple, 3 weeks, and then pull the bucket off, and that gives you some protection, even for rabbits when I plant out
that's a good idea.
Beans and peas. They'll come in, and I just simply take a bucket, set it down, put about 3 seeds in there, and once they get to a height of about a foot or so, I can pull the bucket out and start trellising the plants, and it keeps the rabbits from cleaning house.
What do you think of a 5-gallon bucket?
It'll work the same.
Won't they tip it over?
If you got a possum or a raccoon, they will tip it over, and if you have that, then I would move to a catch-alive trap.
Okay.
And if you've got a skunk, you might want to try something different.
Thank you very much.
Okay, thanks very much, and good luck to you, Bill. We appreciate the call. And let's see if we got time for Gwen in Weyerhaeuser. Gwen, what can we do for you?
Good morning. I have 2 questions. One has to do with apple fruit. We had abundant production last year on Honeycrisp, Cortland, and Macintosh, but the fruit inside the apple, you couldn't, by looking at the appearance of the apple, the trees were loaded and beautiful, but the apple fruit itself was mushy and brown inside. It was suggested that it might be a calcium deficiency, and I'm wondering how you treat for that.
Okay, you're right. It is a calcium deficiency, but it isn't because there's not enough calcium there. It's most likely because of drought. And you had a very dry year up in that part of Wisconsin last year, and you're off to a similar this year. I was up at Spooner, and they said they have only had less than 2 inches of rain since 1st of April. Okay, what I would suggest doing is watering your trees about once a week when we don't have sufficient amount of rain, and that'll take care of a good portion of your problem.
Okay, and my second question has to do with slugs. I'm just about ready to give up. They just decimate my perennial garden.
There are some slug baits that are out there, and you can find those at most of the garden centers. And they look like little pellets, and some people...
Right. I've used those and not with a lot of success. Is it a problem with dogs or cats to use that?
No.
Okay.
It should say on the usually they if you have any concern, cut a piece of plywood about 1 foot by 1 foot, and then put the pellets underneath that, and they'll come in. The other thing is people have more problem when there's bark chip mulch and things like that. The slugs seem to multiply like that moist environment.
And good luck to you, Gwen. Thanks very much. And thanks very much to you, Bob Tomisch, for being with us today. We'll look forward to your next appearance. Yep. Sounds good. Bob Tomisch is a senior lecturer in the Department of Horticulture, UW-Madison and Extension. And if you'd like a CD of the program, you just call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444. Our thanks to Brittany DeAnda for on-air phone production. I'm Jim Packard. On Monday, we'll be talking about ornithology, the beauty of bird watching, with our migrant birds and our resident birds, with Bill Volkert and Noel Cutright here on the Ideas Network.